I think if there are relatives out there, foster care, they ought to let people know. But ultimately, it's too big a task for just that kind of self-help. We need the government to give us whatever information they have, and then we will start doing what we've been doing all year, which is calling these parents and children.
Do you believe Kirsten Gillibrand lied to Congress? Kirsten Nielsen, the secretary of Homeland Security.
I'm not going to characterize it, but I do not feel we've gotten the whole truth from the administration throughout the family separation policy, and I think there's bombshells still to come.
Lee Gallant, I want to thank you for being with us, Deputy Director of the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project, lead lawyer for the ACLU's national challenge to the Trump administration's family separation practice. Democracy Now! Has a job opening, full-time, one-year paid news production fellowship. Check out democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 8 o'clock. Coming up next is Positively Revolting.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society 2018-19 concert season. Tish Hinojosa is the featured performer at the February 15th concert. Singer-songwriter Tish Hinojosa's songs are a blend of Americana, country, Latino, and pop. She has been a featured artist at the White House, Austin City Limits, and a Prairie Home Companion. Again, Tish Hinojosa appearing on the PFS stage on Friday, February 15th at 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church, located at 2901 Southeast Steele Street in Portland, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor La Segua, running February 7th to March 2nd at the Milagro Theater in Portland. La Segua is a Central American cautionary folktale of a young, beautiful woman whom philandering men encounter on their way back home. Her beauty decays into a horror that drives the men mad. The play tells the story of a beautiful woman who was haunted by the specter of La Segua and takes a hard look at Costa Rican values, including ambition, hypocrisy, and follows themes of machismo, vanity, and narcissism. Again, that's La Segua, running February 7th to March 2nd on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights at 7:30 and Sundays at 2 p.m. at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from True West, presenting the Motet February 16th at the Roseland Theater. This is a 21 and over event. Tickets and more information is available online at roselandpdx.com.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
Comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
And good morning, good morning. The time is 4 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, your very own community radio station, and I'm Ani. I'll be your host this morning during Positively Revolting, and I'm excited to introduce Patrick Starnes. He is my guest this morning. We'll be talking about getting money out of politics. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Ani. Thanks for having me.
Patrick is a cabinet maker, and he works tirelessly on this really huge issue of getting big money out of politics. He ran for governor on the Independent Party ticket in 2016 to talk about the inherent problems of huge contributions, sort of buying positions and power in our political system. He pulled out of the race shortly before Election Day and endorsed Kate Brown's candidacy in a very close race. And I want to start off looking at the financing for that gubernatorial race, because I think right there we see what we're talking about, right? So Kate Brown, the incumbent, raised how much money?
I think it was close to $17 million, and Bueller was right there with her.
Right?
Dr. Bueller, yeah.
And one of the contributors, we were just talking before the mics went on, was Phil Knight from Nike. And he gave how much?
Yeah, that was a turning point for me. He gave personally $2 million, but then through the Republicans Governors Association, he gave another $1.5 million as a pass-through. So $3.5 million.
So that is...
From one person.
From one person, $3.5 million thrown behind a candidate just because you think they're a good guy and they're going to do reasonable things for the American public, right?
I guess they're neighbors in Bend.
Right? Probably not so much altruism there is my guess. Now, let's compare and contrast. You had a grassroots campaign and you had how much money?
Well, we self-imposed a limit of $100 per person because we wanted just regular folks to be able to donate. And we traveled all 36 counties in Oregon, and we raised just under $10,000. It was 8 months, 400 miles a week, and less than $10,000. And just before I withdrew, I understand I was polling at like 9%. But then after withdrawing, we just got under 3%.
Mm-hmm. And so again, looking at the comparison, $17 million versus under $10,000. And who, you know, again... in your efforts to have a campaign that was financed fairly, a self-imposed limit. And this is not, something that is, of course, imposed from the outside. Otherwise, we wouldn't see somebody donating $2 million.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Why did you decide to have a self-imposed limit?
Well, I wanted to role model campaign finance reform. I felt like by leading by example was one of the best ways. And we knew that the campaign would get into the millions, you know, like Kitzhaber and Dudley's campaign was like $17 million. This one was over $30
million. Yeah.
And remember, there's like less than 3 million voters. So it was over $10 a vote, right? And we got 50,000 votes for $10,000.
Perhaps a message that that people might want to look at there, or a lesson people might want to look at there. So you have been working on money in politics, money in the political system, both in campaign financing and lobbying, and just the influence. We know that the courts have somehow or another decided that money is speech. That is one of the worst legal fictions that we are living with. But you have decided to focus on money because it is the linchpin for every other issue, is it not?
Yeah, it seems to be the first thing we need to work on before we try to have healthcare reform or environmental reform, or I would argue even educational reform.
And why is that, Patrick?
Well, because you have both sides of an issue. You always have lots of, you know, these special interests donating millions. Like in the environmental issue, you have big timber money. In the fossil fuel, you know, when you're trying to work on climate change, you have fossil fuel money. And then in healthcare, you have big pharma and private health insurance companies. I mean, all these big donors sort of control the legislature and state governments across the country, I would argue.
This Sunday night at the Clinton Street Theater, February 10th, there is a program that is being organized by Jobs with Justice, Healthcare Committee, KABU is a media sponsor for that program. We're proud to be involved with that. The program is called Big Money Agenda, Democracy on the Brink, right? And you'll be a speaker. There's a film. You'll be one of the two speakers. And, you know, that documentary is exploring why Americans are sicker than they should be. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to do this straight from the slug for the event because, damn, well worded. The documentary explores why Americans are sicker than they should be, poorer than they ought to be, and the effects of dark money in politics. So let's look at Americans being poorer than they ought to be. We hear that that big corporations can't afford to pay workers a living wage, forcing workers into public assistance in many cases. And then those workers are then lambasted for using welfare, for using public assistance, food stamp benefits, and that sort of thing, while their CEOs rake in record profits. How does the effect of money in politics, how does money add to that dystopic scenario?
Well, when you have those millionaires and billionaires donating and drowning out the small donors that I had, folks that could afford $100 for 1 year, I would argue even if you raised it to $1,000 limit, that's $20 a week for a working person. That's quite a bit. You know, that means you're probably not eating out that week,
mm-hmm.
every
mm-hmm.
week for 50 weeks. So that's a big deal, $1,000 donation. So when somebody can donate $1 million, because even on Kate Brown's campaign, she had a quarter million from Michael Bloomberg,
mm-hmm.
so the other billionaire. So there was big money on both sides. And that's what's unfair, is that it's drowning out regular folks. And I feel that it also keeps people from engaging in the democracy and participating, because they just feel like, one, their small donation doesn't matter. Two, their vote doesn't matter because, you know, people are being bought and paid for.
Right, right. And it's sort of the same when we look at healthcare, right? We look at healthcare, we look at the interests of the major insurance industries and lobbyists who would be out of job, basically, should we actually get single-payer healthcare, universal coverage. It doesn't seem like the big insurance industries are willing to go quietly into the night.
No, and they were especially at the table, and I would call the ACA or Obamacare a major victory for them, because it became basically a corporate subsidy for those insurance companies. When you get a discounted health insurance premium through that program, then the feds pick up the tab. And one of the problems I had, and I talked about a lot during the governor's race, is that we have this general fund, and that's where all the arguing and the battles begin. But if we had more designated revenue for each service, just sort of like the example is the gas tax, you know, goes for roads, and the more you drive, the more you pay, and that sort of makes sense for folks, and there's less tax anger about that. But when it comes to healthcare, what should be taxed to you know? So during the campaign, I argued those things that are killing us. Junk food is, I love junk food, but it needs to pay, you know, because there's the true cost analysis. Just like a gallon of gas, mm-hmm. there, it would be a lot more if there was a true cost analysis on a gallon of gas.
Oh, absolutely, right.
And same with the food that Safeway and Fred Meyer, all these food stores,
mm-hmm.
which you'll remember in the last 2018 election, they were the ones that sponsored the anti-junk food tax measure that failed in Oregon, which was great.
Sure. I think there might be another way of looking at it, though, in terms of, you know, because we know that taxing any kind of food is going to disproportionately hit poor folk. In what we think about food choices and healthy food choices aside, isn't there actually a way that we could re-engage our priorities spending-wise, that we could look at the obscene amounts of money given to issues. You know, I'm looking at the federal level, the obscene amounts of money that have been poured into the military and defense, which has gone up and up and up steadily for the last 18 years since since 2001. We've seen just a massive increase. We have seen a massive increase in the private prisons industry. Yeah. You know, I'm not sure at the state level, but I'm pretty sure we could find industries that don't actually benefit Oregonians, that we could look at redistributing some of that wealth.
Yeah, and that's been the recent battles with the corporate tax.
Yeah,
that you and I pay over 9%, and they're paying like 1%. So I mean,
tell
that's
me more about
completely
that.
Unfair. I mean, well, if they want personhood, then they should be able to be drafted. And they should be able to pay, the same rates that we pay, mm-hmm. rather than having discounts. And you're right about the federal level, which was way bigger than I could tackle. But that's why I tried to focus on the state level. And having Oregon Health Plan for All was something I was the only governor candidate that was single-payer advocate. And the model I like to use is the Navajo Nation. And the 10,000 members of the Navajo Nation, they're the first place in America that created a junk food tax. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't only to help them with their obesity, diabetes, and heart disease, but also the issue of food deserts,
mm-hmm.
you know, and also making farm markets more viable for poor folks when you have those choices between a dollar Coke and a $2 juice. You know, that disparity needs to be, especially when a Coke only costs 5 cents for Coca-Cola to make that, you know, right. So the profit margin is huge versus the fresh juice or even processed juice. So I followed that example of the Navajo Nation. I thought it was a great example and something that we should explore deeper.
Certainly addressing the very real issues of food deserts.
Oh, yeah.
For many disenfranchised communities and neighborhoods, the only source that you're going to be able to walk to is a convenience store on the corner.
Yeah, and you have that in the inner city, probably here in Portland.
Yeah.
But even in my little village of Brownsville, which is a half hour from any big stores.
Yeah.
But if you want to walk to the store, all we have are a Dairy Mart and a Dollar General.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, the food choices. We do have, what's great, is we do have a farm market on Thursdays, not so much during the winter. But and what farm markets are getting control of, and I support completely, is trying to be able to use an EBT, which is your Oregon Trail food stamp thing, right there at the farm market. So you can use your phone and scan that card. So that makes it a better choice for lower income folks or even the working poor, which I've been a part of that for a long time.
Exactly.
Where you don't qualify for any subsidies, but you're still below.
Paycheck to paycheck, yeah. And it's a struggle.
No surplus.
Yep. Yeah. I want to remind folks, this is a talk radio program. Please do call in with your questions and comments, with your stories about how big money in politics is affecting you. Go ahead and give us a call at 503-231-8187. That's the number to call this morning, 503-231-8187. We'd love to talk to you. I want to also remind you that you can follow along Positively Revolting throughout the week in the Twitterverse. You'll find us at Positive Revolt. On Facebook, you can find our page Positively Revolting, as ever. And I also want to remind you that coming up at 9 o'clock this morning is Beloved Community. Host John Shuck's guests are from the Lawyers Committee for the 9/11 Inquiry and Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. At 10 o'clock, Valley Views. Host Dale Holliday shares her observations about being a woman who is child-free by choice. This is part one of a two-part series. At 10:15, you'll hear flashpoints from Dennis Bernstein from the auspices of KPFA in Berkeley. And at 11 o'clock, The Digital Divide with Rabia Yeaman looks at issues in science, technology, and humanity. All of this is made possible by your generous support. Dear members, please, if you have not yet become a member, go to kboo.fm right now and click the button that says donate, and you know that you are doing your part to support independent, lively community radio where we can have important discussions just like this. Let's go ahead and actually let's bring Brian onto the air. Good morning, Brian.
Hi, good morning. Hi. I don't have very long because I have to get to my job. One of the things when talking about money and politics, and maybe I'm just not paying attention like I should, but it seems like I never hear where all that money is going. And as far as I can tell, all that money is to pay for marketing and advertising on media, right, for the candidates to win.
Exactly.
Seems like what's behind all this money, the media is making huge, all that money is funneling straight to them. And I'd just like to hear a discussion about that. I remember that the Obama, when Obama won, I remember feeling like, well, he won this race a long time ago, and they're just keeping this thing going to rake in the last bit of money to the very bitter end. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Brian, I really wanted to thank you for bringing up the big media, because that it's not just as an independent candidate or third-party candidate. It wasn't just that the two big parties were excluding me like from the debates, but the real heart of it was the big media. And like you said, because I was excluded from two major televised debates at KGW, and the other one was down south in Medford's, another big NBC affiliate. So that's so important that the importance of why I was excluded is important, because I was the one talking about getting big money out of politics. And when we talk about the over $30 million that was spent in this last governor's race, the lion's share obviously went to those ugly ads that were, you know, that we were seeing all the time. And when I would visit senior centers, those poor folks were, you know, sort of trapped in their senior center watching this ugly stuff. And from the beginning, we knew that the majority of their money was going to go to those ugly ads. But what was shocking and disappointing was that they excluded us from being at those debates. And our voice would have rang true across the state if we would have that access.
And what was the rationale for exclusion?
Well, they said I didn't poll over 10%.
And so you were polling at 9.
Right, yeah. And I couldn't afford a poll because one single poll costs $10,000. Mm. And so what we wanted to poll wasn't the usual voters in both parties. We wanted to poll the non-affiliated voters, which is now 800,000, more than 800,000. It's over 30% of the voters in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And so if we had access to the debates, and it wasn't just the TV stations, the big corporate TV stations, it's also the Oregonian. When they had the weekly issues for Brown and Bueller, I would call in and say, look, I can talk about education. I was on the school board for 10 years. I actually have more experience with education on the ground than the other two. But they said, they just finally told me, they said, Patrick, we don't have enough inches for a third column. I was like, wow.
That's kind of naked, right?
That's pretty bold. And
yeah,
especially since the majority, I would argue, are not with Pepsi and Coke. 38% of us are not registered with Democrat and Republican. So it's not a minority.
Right. Let's talk about that as well in that two-party system. How do these things all, you know, I know that there is a direct tie, big money, two parties, Coke or Pepsi. How does the big money affect third party politics or independent candidates?
Well, it starts at the primary level. You know, 30% of the voters didn't get a governor candidate in May in their primary ballot. What was another shocker for us, the independent party opened their primary to non-affiliated voters, but that was just in quotes, because the process to get an independent party ballot was ridiculous. My wife's a non-affiliated voter, or they call them NAVs. And in the voter's pamphlet, you had to know where to find this little application, which is like a one-inch thing you had to fill out. And on the back of it, or anywhere on it, there was no address to send it to. So we ended up taking the voter's pamphlet in with her filled out form to the county elections office and say, what do we do with this?
Right.
They didn't know. So the number
of... But Oregon has open primaries.
Not really. Yeah. The number of non-affiliated voters that voted in my independent primary, I had two challengers during the May primary, was 541 non-affiliated voters out of 830,000 non-affiliated voters. So I would call that voter suppression.
That would seem to be 503-231-8187. Wow, is what I have to say about that. Let's go ahead and talk to David. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Oh, morning. Yeah, I've been interested in this for a bunch of years because it used to be that the League of Women Voters, which was an official 501c3 nonprofit, they would manage debates. And back in the Reagan days, if I understand right, the debate commission was created by both the Democrats and Republicans, and they went out of their way to exclude third-party people or anybody they didn't like. And so that nonprofit is basically a fraud. You know, a nonprofit is supposed to work toward the best interests of all citizens. But the intent of the debate commission and, you know, the local versions of the debate commission, they're a corporation which is designed to help only the Democrats and Republicans. And so when you're talking about non-affiliated voters, if I understand right, the Democrats have got a slight edge over Republicans. There's like 35% Democrats and, 30% Republicans.
25, actually.
Is it 45?
No, 25 for the R's.
Okay, 25, yeah. I see. And so then the rest are unaffiliated, and that comes to what, about 40% then? Or
38, yeah.
Yeah, so that's pretty much the same numbers nationwide, all 50 states. And so the whole idea that 40% of America's population don't get included in the debate, they don't get their voices out, and they're cheated by a nonprofit that only serves the two parties. So if I were you, I'd work on trying to sue that nonprofit and make sure that it serves all of us. It's something I worked with the Ralph Nader campaign 25 years ago, and he was heralded by both sides. Democrats, Republicans, rich or poor, young and old, all supported Nader because he was an honest guy. And the idea that he actually got arrested for even showing up at the debate in St. Louis. You know, just showing up had him arrested. And the idea that it was this debate commission that pretends to be serving the public, when in fact it has no proof that it's ever served anyone.
Yeah, I'd like to actually defend the League of Women Voters because...
they dropped out. League of Women Voters got out of the business, basically.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we don't have a debate commission like you're talking about in Oregon. I wish we did, especially including all the community colleges would be awesome. But to give you a little backstory on what happened in the governor's race, the League of Women Voters, AARP, and the Portland City Club did want to host a debate. And I was the first one that signed up for it. Since the Independent Party was considered a major party because we were over the 5% line, which makes you a major party, all three of us were invited. And this is where it fell on the two-party system. When they declined to come to the debate, that's when the League of Women Voters, AARP, and the Portland City Club couldn't have the debate.
So
people don't show up, or they decline to show up.
So you said, yes, you're there, you're ready to debate. And neither of the major parties decided that that was worth their while?
Yeah, and we saw this all across the state. I was invited to Chamber of Commerce candidate forums in the Dalles, Astoria, the Association of University Women in Astoria, because, they're hosting their mayor race. They're hosting their county commissioners and their state reps, and they're hosting Congress, Senate, and governor. I was the only governor candidate often at these candidate forums, and I was traveling all over the state. And I mean, it's only an hour and a half to the Dalles from Portland.
Right.
So it's not a, in my book, it's not a big deal if you live in Portland to come to the Dalles and meet 200 people. And they were really upset that I was the only one there.
Well, like I was saying, the nonprofit status still should be challenged. The nonprofit status of the Democrats and Republicans then should be challenged, because if they're pretending to be so great and powerful, but that they can't, you know, it's supposed to be equal justice under the law. And so the idea that that the taxpayer is not served by someone purporting to be a political party, and they don't even serve the public by displaying their wares before Election Day, it's like bait and switch.
Mm-hmm.
And there are any number of different ways that could be challenged. And I mean, it's good you're discussing it right now, but they really need to be challenged. I'm still furious about Nader getting arrested, and that was 25 years ago.
Yeah, and yeah. Jill Stein was arrested too.
Yeah.
Sure.
We considered it at KGW. My wife and I discussed. I had an equal invite to a mental health group, and I chose to go speak to that mental health group, even though my supporters were there protesting at KGW outside. I don't think it got much media coverage, because we're talking about
the media getting, doesn't tend to cover themselves in a negative light.
Yeah, when we're talking about getting big money out of politics, you're talking about getting big money out of their pocket.
Out of mainstream media. Yeah. All right, David, thank you so much for your call.
Thanks, David. Yeah, speaking of community media, I really wanted to congratulate you on your silver anniversary here.
Oh, thank you very much, Patrick.
And I've heard a lot of friends and family love the title, because I've always been hopefully discontent.
Discontent also works.
And, yeah, and I'm also currently cautiously optimistic that we're going to have campaign finance reform.
Absolutely, because, my God, we have to hang on to that optimism. And thank you so much for the kind words. 503-231-8187, the number to call. Jump on into this conversation. My name is Ani, and you are listening to KBOO, your community radio station. This is Positively Revolting, and my guest this morning is Patrick Starnes. Patrick is an organizer around the issue of campaign finance reform, around getting big money out of politics, and looking at the effects that big money in politics has on wage suppression, on workers' rights, on health care, on our environment, on the LNG issues around Coos County, right? I mean, there are so much that industry drives in the state, in this country, that doesn't seem to be in the people's best interest.
Yeah, the LNG is a great example of that in the governor's race.
Mm-hmm.
Bueller came out clearly in favor of it because he had $1 million from the timber industry, which is where I grew up in Roseburg. It's the big timber lobby down there. Brown was neutral because she received steelworker money, you know, who want those pipeline jobs. But I was the only candidate that was clearly opposed to the LNG, and have been since it started. I remember we were talking about it before the show. It used to be called the Williams Connector.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's a Canadian company, and it just won't go away. And this pipeline issue has traveled across the West Coast. You know, it started, they were trying to put it through California. They ran them out of the state. Then they wound it down the Columbia River, right?
Right.
And you all ran them out of here. So now it's landing in the poorest part of Oregon.
Right.
Coos Bay and Douglas County.
And Coos and Douglas counties have been economically depressed since the timber industry really bottomed out, sold out its workers, and you know, it was there to gobble the last of the resource dollars, right? And so now this is their new plan. It's a bad deal for the state.
Yeah, it's a bad deal for the state. It's a bad deal for private property owners. It's a bad deal for tribal landowners or manage, you know, the native lands.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bad deal for the environment. I mean, these jobs, even for the steel workers, are so short term compared to the long term effects. I mean, it's a 100-foot swath of pipeline, 3-foot pipeline through national forest, drilled under rivers and creeks.
In environmentally very sensitive areas.
Yeah, with the wildfires, can you imagine?
Yes.
And they're so cheap, they refuse to odorize the natural gas. The reason they odorize it, that stinky sulfur smell, is so the vultures circle over the leak. I learned about that. That was pretty wild that they use the vultures' nature to find the leak.
I didn't know that part.
Yeah.
I knew it had been odorized so that we would know when there was a rupture. We would know that there, something wrong here. Hadn't realized the vultures played a part in this. Vultures are one of my favorite animals on the planet. Okay, let's hear it for vultures. 503-231-8187 is the number to call, just like Mary Jane did. Good morning, Mary Jane. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Annie. I just first wanted to say thank you for the lovely, wonderful, beautiful program last week. I, too, enjoyed it. And I was cooking hedgehogs and winter chanterelles last week, thinking of you and Annie, because I think that's the last time I called it last year about this time. But your guest, I've been trying to warm up my little pad here, so I think he's a neighbor. You're in Brownsville. I'm in Sweet Home.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
On the Santiam River. You live up river there, yep.
Yeah. Well, thanks for being there and sharing your experiences. And I know what you mean about the senior people. I live in a senior community in Sweet Home. It's triplexes and duplexes. I came off the mountain a few years back. But, yeah, they're all in there watching Fox News. I know it. You know, I walk a lot. I walk in town, mingle with the people in town and the business people, and they're all howdy-doody people. And I try to talk to them about bigotry and, just hate. We have a lot of flag wavers around here. And thank you for bringing up about Jill Stein being in the handcuffs, too, because I did vote for Ralph Nader many years ago and probably Dick Gregory. But I'm going to go back. I just want to tell a little story. In the early 60s, when we came back from France, my dad was in the military. Our home base was Sacramento. And I lived a few blocks from Senator Cranston. I don't know if you know of him. He died from cancer years ago. But I went around with his son, Robin. And, I mean, they lived a few blocks from us. And he was a senator, and my dad was a master sergeant. And you know what I'm saying? The money is just gotten so out of hand. So I'm really glad you guys are addressing it. And thanks. I just wanted to say hi and thank you for being there and be safe driving home.
Thanks for calling in, neighbor.
Thanks so much, Mary Jane.
Okay, love you guys.
Take good care. Bye bye. 503-231-8187, the number to call. So, Patrick, what are the major parts of campaign finance reform? How do we actually, we know it's bad. We've spent a half hour talking about, boy, God, it's bad. Mm-hmm. How do we get rid of it?
Yeah, Oregon is 49th in the country on campaign finance rules. So that's pretty
almost dead last.
Yeah, thank God for Mississippi. But
I say that every day.
Every effort we do. Even if we become 30th, that'll be a great success. So during the campaign, like we talked earlier, I focused on campaign finance reform because we knew that it was going to get into the millions with the other two. And then at the week before the election, when I was filling out my ballot and Kate Brown and I were voting the same on all those ballot measures, I thought, I really need to sit down with her and talk about this campaign finance one-on-one. So I reached out to their campaign. We met at a labor hall not far from here, just the two of us, and talked about how she felt about it. And even as a Secretary of State, she had tried. But the system is so cumbersome and so corrupt that she had no luck. But what she did agree to me was to do a constitutional amendment. Because if you study the history of Oregon campaign finance reform, there's been many successful efforts to pass initiatives for campaign finance, but then it gets thrown out in the court. So her and I agreed that the constitutional amendment was the first priority for campaign finance reform. And if you take local examples, Multnomah County passed in 2016 the campaign finance reform initiative for the county commissioner's race, and it was 89%. So the whole state is looking at that and saying, wow, this is bipartisan.
Mm-hmm.
And I experienced that traveling
across.
That's
very strong support. Yeah. I don't know that we could get 89% agreement on anything.
Yeah, well, and then when they did the city initiative in 2018, this last election, it was 87. So, right. I mean, both of them are in the 90s, which is pretty much like unanimous.
Yeah.
So the effort is strong. I think that the state is ready, especially after this last governor's race. So we agreed that that's the first priority. So soon after the election in December, I started going to Salem. I met with the Senate President, Peter Courtney. And soon after that, he created a new campaign finance committee. The Senate had never had one. And it was interesting, who he appointed was Jeff Golden from down in the LNG area in Ashland, who ran like I did with no PAC money and no corporate money. And he won not only his Democratic primary seat, which was well-funded on the other side, but his general election. So he was an example of a winner of campaign finance reform. So the Senate President appointed him to the chair of this committee. So they're going to have, and they do have, initiatives, resolutions, I should say, on their table, on their desk, to put through their committee. At parallel to that, we're putting pressure on the Speaker, Tina Kotek, to create a similar committee. And that, if anyone's from Northern Portland, please call the Speaker's office, your state representative, Tina Kotek, and say it's time for the House to also have a campaign finance committee, just like they do in the Senate. Because why these things are important to have these special committees is so they don't die in the Rules Committee, which is like the graveyard for progressive legislation that it languishes. There's no deadlines in the Rules Committee. So that's why we're really excited about having the Speaker create this new committee. So please call in to the Speaker's office and say you would love to see a campaign finance committee. So I've been dedicated my personal time and my life to one day a week. Every Wednesday I go to Salem. My goal is to meet all 90 state reps and state senators and hear them out about their ideas for campaign finance reform and also explain my experience with it. So, and it seems, again, to be bipartisan. You know, a lot of, let's take a state rep from anywhere. They usually come from a school board.
Mm-hmm.
Education's an important issue. Or maybe they were a former nurse, so healthcare is a... And they have to run every 2 years.
Right.
And they did not sign up for Dial In for Dollars. I mean, one of the state house races was $1 million. So,
and
I mean,
and
you
salary,
have to do it every...
You know,
yeah,
I mean,
it's $24,000.
Right.
And it's a part-time job.
And so you can obviously see the influence.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it, I think there's really very few places it's more transparent than when you look at the salary of a state rep and the obscene levels of contributions from major industries given to them for their races every 2 years.
Yeah. Big pharma is a big contributor. It'd be 20 grand easily for...
Wow.
And some of the big pharmas are in Holland, you know.
Right.
They're not even in America.
How, I mean, so to me, it's just like, how do people not see this, right? How, but what I'm hearing from you is that most people do see.
They do, especially under 30. When I'm going through Salem and all the interns and staffers are mostly under 30, on both sides of the aisle, they get it immediately.
Right.
Now they have to convince their boss, you know, who may be like me, a baby boomer or something. But I think it's the timing is right. The stars are lined up, like the governor said. To rein this in. And so the other parts is not only the constitutional amendment, which would allow us to have limits, which is the second part, but also we have to deal with dark money. Because dark money is outside of the candidate's race. It comes from outside, and that's where the Citizens United, you know, we can't limit that according to Citizens United, but what we can do is put it into the sunshine so it's no longer dark.
Right,
which
the
means
vampire laws.
Yeah, so you need like paid for by rules, which the
can you explain dark money just real simply for our listeners? What do you mean when you say dark money?
Well, let's take our governor's race. Each of the candidates had their own PAC. I even had mine, which is a small, you know, small donation. But then there are outside PACs that can buy ads, like Citizens United. I think in Oregon it was Priority Oregon with some of those nasty ads about the mom reading to the kid mm-hmm. in bed and all that kind of stuff. But that money can't be limited, according to Citizens United ruling. It's outside of the candidates. They can't coordinate with the candidate. That's illegal. But there are hardly any disclosure laws in Oregon for that. So that's the part that we can fix. We can't maybe limit that, because, you know, the concern with any kind of campaign finance reform is sort of like whack-a-mole, you know, or plug the dam. It's like mm-hmm. you plug this spot and then it starts leaking over here, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but if we have transparency across the board, then we can decide if we want to support that candidate because the Koch brothers or whoever are donating millions to that opponent.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought up the Koch brothers, because we know that the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, is a huge issue, right? That they sort of fly these sort of trial balloons state by state to enact really nefarious anti-people, pro-big business,
yeah, pro-corporate,
issues. And that, you know, suddenly five states seem to have nearly identically worded bills coming out just about at the same time, because I guess just thoughts are in the air and everyone just decided this was a good idea. No, because it is being handed out by this national conservative.
Well-funded.
Well-funded doesn't even begin right. to cut it. It's the pack of the 1%, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so to see that influence state by state, you know, we realize that in each state it's a problem. And when we start stacking them next to each other, we see that this is, in fact, you know, a way to do national legislation without touching the federal.
Yeah. There's parallel to this movie we're going to see Sunday at the Clinton, The Big Money Agenda, which has got more of a focus on healthcare. Mm-hmm. The other movie I recommend that just came out in 2018 was the movie Dark Money. Mm-hmm. PBS has, I think you can download it. What's interesting about that, it focused on Montana, which in the turn of the century, in the 1900s, it was owned by the mining industry. You know, we think it's bad with the timber industry, but they own the media, they own the governor, they own the both houses of the legislature, but they didn't own the ballot initiative. Mm. So in 1912, Montana had the oldest campaign finance laws in the country. I didn't know that until I watched this movie. And so now, but since Citizens United, a lot of those rules have been reversed. And so now, even in Montana, they're attacking Republicans with this outside money, this dark money, because they're not Republican enough, right? So it's a great movie. I recommend it. It's called Dark Money, and I think you can download it from PBS, because it goes into one state as an example, especially since they had some of the oldest campaign finance laws.
Let's go ahead and talk to our next caller. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. We have just about 10 minutes left or so give a call right now if you'd like to get in, and let's talk to Stephen. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm completely dumbfounded by the extent of brainwashing from the corporate media, because me paying attention, I just wrote in Bernie because it was the only logical candidate, you know, even though the Democrats kind of threw him under the bus.
I don't think kind of threw him under the bus is actually an accurate statement.
Clearly.
Absolutely and completely, perhaps, would be a more accurate statement.
Why didn't people vote with their heart and write in what they wanted? You know, I just don't get it.
Well, Stephen, this brings up another good election reform issue that we should discuss. Scored voting, which I'm more of an advocate or in favor of a new thing called star voting. But there is also ranked choice voting.
Ranked choice voting is the one I'm more familiar with.
Yeah,
can you explain those?
Right, that's where you are able to vote your heart first. Like in my race, if you supported the issues I was talking about, you could vote me first and then Kate Brown second. But yeah, the important thing
for... I think that's the greatest thing that could happen.
Yeah, and the most important thing and why I support that is because it'll increase voter turnout. And
definitely.
When you can't vote for who you really want to, and you have the choice of two evil kind of thing, you get a terrible turnout. And we want an excellent turnout, and we want every little voter to donate $20 or whatever they can do.
Exactly what I did for Bernie.
Good. Good for you, Stephen.
So okay, I also
keep your eye on that.
Wisdom, if you don't mind.
Keep your eye on score voting in Oregon.
What was
so
your?
I have a little comment about some words and meanings.
Okay.
If you want to hear it.
Try it.
So it seems to me the word, when you say I have to do something, right? Have is a possession. It's the meaning is lost. The meaning actually is must, right? I must do something, right? It's not I have. When you say I have to do something, that means you possess this to do, right? Mm-hmm. And what I think people should think about that when they say I have to do something, it's the meaning is if you mean must do something, then that should be the word.
Okay.
But have is possessing. Take possession of what you have to do.
Yeah, that's a good point. I've always said the only cure for cynicism is action. And that's what's motivated me, because I've become at times very cynical and I've went off the grid and unplugged.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm back and I just feel like I must, like mm-hmm. you're saying,
mm-hmm.
do something about this, because I must do something about climate change
mm-hmm.
and I must do something about healthcare reform. So I'm glad you made that distinction.
It is, it's an important point that we have. Really, the onus is on us to take action now. And action is the antidote to despair. And God knows despair is rampant at this point, right? 503-231-8187, the number to call this morning. Got about 6 minutes left. Let's talk about Sunday night.
Okay. Yeah.
So the Clinton Street Theater, 26 in Southeast Clinton, there is a program on Sunday at 7 o'clock. You'll be one of the speakers.
Yeah, and we'll be there program. At 6:30. I think that's when they're opening the doors. And there's a fellow, a doctor, that's going to be there speaking about how the direct impacts on healthcare of big money. And I'll be speaking like we just did today about how it's the heart of most issues in Oregon and how we're like 49th in the country, which is embarrassing, and what we can do this session, which ends in June, that we have to do, because this constitutional amendment is just a referral to the voters. This will be on the 2020 ballot. There's also a group, Honest Elections, who were successful with Multnomah County, getting big money out of Multnomah County elections and the city elections here. HonestElections.org will be bringing their ballot to the theater to get your signatures to get their initiative on the 2020 ballot as well. So, yeah, it's going to be not only a great film to watch and energizing and activating, but there'll be actions you can do right there.
And against that is this Sunday night. And yeah, it is 6:30. I stand corrected. 6:30.
Well, the movie starts at 7, yeah.
So. But you'll want to get there early is my guess if you're going. And that is at the Clinton Street. Lots of information and lots of ways to plug in. So it's very, what I'm feeling like, you know, we do so many things that are like, oh my God, this is dreadful. Things are bad. This is very action-oriented. And it sounds like it's going to be a very spirited and uplifting night of how we can come together to fix things.
Yeah, and if folks follow this issue throughout the session, we're going to need everyone's help with each state representative. Because people, as it comes down to crunch time, they'll start hemming and hawing because the party leadership may say, why do we want to fix it if it's not broken? But the people want it to fix it, and we need to put pressure on our state reps and state senators.
And it's obviously broken.
Obviously.
Let's go ahead and talk to George. Good morning, George. You're on the air.
Hey, Annie, and just thank you so much. And in thinking about what it is we try to fix, I was looking at an old book by Richard Wolff a few years ago
mm-hmm.
about democracy and its problems under capitalism. And then I noticed I had a clipping stuck in the book from the Wall Street Journal. And I thought, well, if we are going to try to fix this at the state legislature level, maybe we'd better take a look at the overwhelming mess the global economy is in. And I want to mention this article, and I think it's available to people who go online and get it from the Wall Street Journal. Maybe the library would get copies. And this was printed on March 9th, 1987, and the title, the headline is Glutted Markets. And then under that, the subheadline, A Global Overcapacity Hurts Many Industries, No Easy Cure Is Seen. And under that, among those hit are autos, steel, computers, chips, some chemicals recover. One winner, the consumer. And I think that's something that we need to think about, is the overwhelming mess of the gigantic system of capital. So I'll get off the air here. I just want to listen to you guys talking.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, George.
Thanks, George. I want to remind folks, so it's not only going to be this struggle and battle during the legislative session, which ends in June, for all of you to put pressure on your state reps. But then once it's referred to the ballot, that's another battle, right? So during when these initiatives are on the ballot, you're going to have all this big money again, because 2020 will still be the wild, wild west. We'll still have no limits on the Secretary of State's race, or no limits on these campaign ballot measures. So we're going to need you during the session in June or to the end of June, and then we'll need you in 2020 during that big money battle. Hopefully it'll be the last big money battle in Oregon.
Let's go ahead, and we have one last caller. We've got 2 minutes. Mike, you are on the air.
Morning, KBOO.
Good morning, Mike. You're on the air. You've got 1 minute.
Voters Day holiday. Enough said. Just think of the intention that would communicate mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. people. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Good idea.
Thank you.
Yep, good idea. And an open primary.
Yeah, so really looking at all of the fixes to to invigorate. I'm not even sure to reinvigorate, because I'm not entirely sure our democracy was ever working the way we were told it was in third grade civics class, right? Mm-hmm. But to actually live up to those ideals that we were taught in third grade civics class, there are a number of things that need doing. And Patrick, what I'm hearing you say is getting big money out of politics is one of the first to look
at. It's the first priority, which leads to other reforms that we can enjoy.
Like a voter holiday, like looking at gerrymandered districting.
Single-payer health care.
Yeah.
All the attacks on the environment and climate change by the big fossil fuel money.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we have a full plate. And
indeed.
Start now, yeah.
Indeed. I thank you so very much for what you do and what you've been doing. Your work is tremendously important. We hope to hear from you again soon. And again, those details for Sunday night at the Clinton Street looks to be 6:30 at the Clinton Street. The Big Money Agenda is the film screening. And you can hear from Patrick as well as Sam Metz, who is from the Mad as Hell Doctors, talking about single pairing and the National Health Program. So thank you all for listening. Patrick, thank you for joining me this morning,
Anna.
On Positively Revolting.
Happy birthday, 25 years.
Woohoo! And 25 to go.
That's right.
There comes a time when every second, every day, your vote.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Sexbots Cat Party on Saturday, February 9th at 9 p.m. at the Bithouse Saloon in Portland. One-woman art pop trickster, The Sexbots, is back with a rap album about losing it and becoming a cat lady. This album has recurring themes of violence against women, street harassment, loneliness, and quietly watching one's life disintegrate. This event is the album release party and features kitty go-go's, a cat lady costume contest, and a pet psychic. Again, that's the Sexbots Cat Party on Saturday, February 9th at 9 p.m. at the Bithouse Saloon, 727 Southeast Grand Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events. And this is KBOO Portland. It's 9 a.m., and that means it's time for Beloved Community with your host, John Shuck, featuring guests from the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry and Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. There's more coming up, and we'll tell you more about it later. For now, this is the Beloved Community on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the Beloved Community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence, however, is bitterness.